Hi, I'm Tanya Thompson, horror writer and creator of Nightlight, a horror podcast featuring fiction from Black writers across the diaspora. The new year is upon us, and with it, lots of hope and changes. First off, big thanks to Ryan Chandler, who donated to the podcast via PayPal and funded two episodes for us all to enjoy. This isn't the first time Ryan's donated, which proves you don't have to be a patron to be a member of the Nightlight Legion. Thank you, Ryan. If you'd like to be like Ryan, you can donate via PayPal at paypal.me/nightlightpodcast. You can also become a member of the Nightlight Legion on Patreon at patreon.com/nightlightpod and get cool perks like bonus stories, behind-the-scenes posts, and announcements. Our patrons are currently funding one episode a month, but we know how much you love weekly episodes, so starting today, you can contribute to our GoFundMe for Season 2 to get us over the hump so that we can pay Black writers and produce weekly episodes. Just go to GoFundMe.com/NightlightPod. So enough with all the housekeeping announcements. Let's talk about today's story. Many of you know I love classical horror. Poe, Mary Shelley, and Shirley Jackson all have a home on my bookshelf. But one of the first pieces of classic horror I ever read was The Legend of Sleepy Hollow by Washington Irving. I sometimes forget about that day, perusing my step-grandmother's bookshelf, hunting for something to read that wasn't about quilting or romance. I'd heard of The Headless Horseman, but at the time I wasn't aware there was an actual written story it came from. The title caught my attention, and I began to read. The first few sentences weren't terribly interesting, and I almost put the book away when my eyes caught the word apparition. I read on. The dominant spirit, however, that haunts this enchanted region and seems to be commander-in-chief of all the powers of the air is the apparition of a figure on horseback without a head. And I was hooked. Today's story is a reimagining of the classic from a Black perspective, and yes, during the author interview, we talk about Sleepy Hollow on Fox and what it could have been and should have been. This legend is chock-full of opportunity for exploration via marginalized perspectives, and this story fits nicely into a subgenre I hope to read more of. Now, without further ado, here's The Deacon's Girl by Jennifer Harris.
There aren't many people that can claim what the Deacon family bloodline can. We know where the head of the Husson is. You know who the Husson is. You must know. The Husson is who Washington Irving called the Headless Horseman. My family, 10-plus generations removed from enslavement, know where it is. It was my paternal, beyond-great-grandfather who saw the Continental Soldier blow the head off the Husson with a cannonball. He, Grandpa Deacon, joined the Continental Army for his freedom. He was in the woods, scouting, as the family story says. He saw the Husson wound other soldiers before the Continental Soldier, marred by the Husson sword, killed him with a cannonball and powder. The story goes that the cannonball met the head of the Husson with the force of a ripe melon thrown against the wall. The type of thud which assures you whatever you hit was dead, or should be. Supposedly, Deacon stood there, watching the blood pulse and pump from the bloody stump where the head once was. Grandpa Deacon said he watched one of the soldiers pick the head up by his short black hair. The family story says the Husson's eyes looked at him, through him, at nothing. Grandpa Deacon is supposed to have said, "Them eyes had a coal black, just like that old Nan horse." My soul shivered when this story was retold. All I could think about when this story was whispered loudly, when I was forced to recite it, was the bloody trophy long dead soldiers carried with its eyes open, seeing nothing along its final walk in the winter bare woods. I had nightmares frequently about the mouth of the Husson hanging open in the shape of a scream to protest his dispatched burial. Its eyes open as the cold dirt filled the open mouth and covered the open eyes. He was too scared to move, but kept watching. From where he stood, he was able to tell where they took its head. The family story goes, my great-grandfather saw these soldiers bury the Husson head in what his own mother called the Haunt Woods. They buried that demon head deep in that old black dirt of them Haunt Woods, she's supposed to have said. Don't nothing come out of there alive and talk. My grandfather, Thomas, told me this. Just like he had told his son, my daddy. My family, with all its other trauma, had to keep the secret of where the head of the Husson lay. Grandpa Deacon is supposed to have stayed in those trees, trailing behind the soldiers. From his perch, Deacon saw the macabre procession take the cold, bloody body of the Hessian to this big black walnut tree. They threw it in the hollowed out space in the tree, tossing the head in after before covering the head, severed from its body, with soil. He waited until they disappeared over the horizon. Deacon went to the tree, now a grave, musket in hand. The story said he saw the dirt they packed into the tree begin to pulse like a heartbeat. He was only supposed to scout, looking for redcoats. He was to relay the position of the redcoats. He was the best scout his regiment had, which is why he got a musket. I would often wonder what he would have done had something come out of the tree. A musket would not have stopped it. He feared the commander of his unit would tell his old master he didn't obey a direct order. If that happened, he wouldn't get to be free. All his promises to his wife and their new baby would be for naught. My family, both slave and free, came from upstate New York. They knew the legend of Irving wasn't a legend. It was a curse. We couldn't tell anyone growing up. I remember at Halloween how everyone would get to choose a costume, real or imagined, deciding what they wanted to be. I couldn't get dressed up, and after fourth grade, I stopped asking. I couldn't go trick-or-treating until I was old enough to sprint over Gallows Bridge, over that big body of water called Lake Hollow, or as the locals call it, Hollow Lake. They call it that because of the legend that no one seems to believe in but us. My paternal grandmother, her too, a granddaughter of Deacon, would make me wear a gris-gris under my costume. Wormwood, new grave dirt, and rosewater. This is how my mama found out I had allergies. There were blood red splotches all over my chest and neck where it touched me. She said the gris-gris made me invisible to the dead. I remember being in first grade when we moved to the other side of a bridge in Albany where water was. Demons and spirits can't cross water, Avery. That was the only answer my parents gave me. Every fall, I had to recite to my grandfather what not to do. Avery, I would look up at him because he was so tall. He was always so serious when I had to repeat the instructions. You remember what to do? I would take a deep breath in, remember his exact wording. Don't go in the woods. Don't let nobody know you know the Hessian is real and is real angry at our family. We could have given the Hessian his head back, but we didn't. My better than 10-time great-grandfather, the slave that saw this all happen, could have given him his head back. Deacon could have made all this go away. He could have made us normal. I grew to hate and fear Halloween. My sister, Tamara, drowned when I was 11, and she 17. The police report my parents requested from the Albany Police Department said my sister had water in her lungs. I remember my grandfather fighting with my mother, telling her the real reason why she died. She didn't listen. Tammy didn't never listen. She dead because she was being fast. I was so mad listening to the grown folks' conversation from the heating vent in my room. As much as I loved my grandfather, I hated him then. I had enshrined the last memories I had of my sister. I held dear the memory of the last night Tamara went out. Halloween. She did her hair, put on her makeup. Ryan and I are going out. I don't care about no damn curse. I sat on the side of the bathtub, thinking how pretty she was, and I wasn't. It's some old homespun family shit Grandpa made up to keep his kids underfoot. The red dress she wore had gold trim along the slender red straps, stopping a little above her knee. Ryan's favorite color is red, and the Chinese say that red is for good luck, so I'll be fine. She didn't wear the gris-gris Grandma made her. Tamara wasn't allergic to it like I was. She just didn't believe in it. I make my own destiny, she'd said, telling my parents the same thing when they asked why she didn't wear it. Tamara looked at the shades of bronze, false lashes, with a cat eyeliner, blending a little bit more at the corner with her finger. She wore the gold bally earrings Mama gave her for her 17th birthday. Her hair was down, freshly relaxed and curled under. I watched her make faces in the mirror, pretending to pin it up before letting the length fall all over and past her shoulders. Hot death, she said, turning in the mirror. I knew she was going to the bridge after a movie with Ryan. She wasn't supposed to go. She had no protection. She had no business going where Mama and Daddy told her not to, especially on Halloween night. Her legs were long and smooth, feet bare on the bathroom tile. Tamara had been itching to wear the gold 9 West heels she had saved up for. They were going to see some movie. I think it was the last Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol. "I'll be back later, Ava," she had winked at me and left the bathroom with the ease breezes have. Then she jumped in her boyfriend Ryan's red Mazda to speed away. I woke up to screaming and beating on the door of my parents' house on All Saints Day. Ryan was screaming about blood, a horse, and Tamara. "They weren't that far from Gallows Bridge," Ryan said. "I wanted to show her the Orion constellation," he said, sniffling and half screaming. "The best place to see them was near the dark woods, about 3 miles from Gallows Bridge." As he cried, I watched him from the foyer on the stairs. Tam said she didn't want to go home yet. His face was in his hands as he sat on the Navy couch, now ruined with memories and probably my sister's blood on his shirt. His car was on the other side of the bridge. Ryan said he heard a horse, heard hooves. I saw Tamara look up. She was scared and told me to run. Ryan still didn't move his head from his hands. We ran towards my car, ran towards the bridge. I parked at the bottom of the hill. I stood there in my Supergirl nightshirt and bit my lip. I felt hot tears roll down my face as Ryan spoke. The tears brought me comfort, so I didn't wipe them away. She screamed. I turned to go get her. And this big black horse, the red eyes. He moved his hands from his dirty face. Something was behind her. He focused ahead, looking at me, I was sure. I saw this dude on horseback, grabbing her hair, and he swallowed air, scared to go on. Tam was screaming, trying to get away. He looked at my parents again on the couch. There was this wind that blew and knocked me out. I opened my eyes and... He paused, seeing her head leave her body again. Her head was gone. Ryan knew about the legend. He knew about those woods. They were halfway home. She was almost over the water. I remembered how shaky his voice was, how dirty his clothes still were, the splotches of blood and mud on his green polo shirt. He was in Bellevue Psych Ward in New York City for 3 years because no one believed him, and his parents were scared for him. He said when he came to on the side of the bridge, Tamara's headless body, still in her pretty red dress, was in the water. She was found in a similar fashion as my grandfather's brother, my great uncle Tuck, drowned, but he had no head. My family knew. We always knew. We kept the secret to save ourselves. For my sister, for Ryan, for Uncle Tuck, I needed this to be over. I decided a week before Halloween, after my 18th birthday, I was going to send it, whatever it was, back to hell, or wherever things like this come from. My grandmother, Ethel, being the old conjure woman she was, told me the best way to catch a haunt. She told me I would have to wait until the sun goes down or right when it comes up. I was going to take a gris-gris she had made me and go. I had her garden shovel and my iron nails for protection. It was 3 days before Halloween. I woke up at 5 a.m. I looked at the ceiling, breathing deep. "I'm going to go, Tammy. It's going to end." I got dressed in all black, a sweatshirt and pants. Both things belonged to Tamara that I convinced my mother to let me have. I walked downstairs through the dining room and the kitchen, going to the back door toward my grandmother's shed for a shovel. With my gris-gris, my nails, and the shovel, I started out towards Haunt Woods. I walked, careful to avoid the bridge. The sun wasn't up. My footsteps were brisk through the leaves as they crunched under my feet. I grabbed my shovel tighter, flexing my right hand around the oak handle. I concentrated on my steps, ignored the itching around my neck. There was the crunch of leaves behind me and a quick trotting. I took a deep breath and held it, felt my hands tense around the handle. I exhaled and continued through the ever-dense grass. I lost my footing and tripped. I clutched the shovel, bearing up on it to be upright again. The trotting got closer, louder, and I laid on the ground, eyes closed. My grandpa said that you would need to be still when you came across an angry horse. The worst thing you could do was lay down on the ground. But I couldn't get up. There was a whinny and stomping of hooves near my raised shoulder. "Avery!" I couldn't move. I looked up to see Mr. Curtis riding his sienna-colored horse, Cinnamon. The early morning sun gave me an outline of his face, covered by the floppy hat he wore. "You know better than to be on the ground when you hear a horse." I relaxed my gaze and studied Cinnamon, refused to move. "Be careful, little Miss Deacon." You best get home. He clapped the reins of the horse and trotted away. I stood up, leaning on my shovel. I held the shovel tighter to ignore the itching. I remembered what my grandparents said as I wandered towards the oak and elm woods. I knew the tree had to be big. It had to be old. The soil around it had to be soft and loose. My stock were all farmers, people of the earth. I knew what loose dirt and packed dirt looked like. I closed my eyes and prayed to my grandpa Deacon, begging him to help me. It got colder as I walked. The weather report on Channel 7 said today was going to be better than 60 degrees. But I felt my teeth chatter against my bottom lip. I knew the light wouldn't reach where I was going. I heard crows and something else running behind me, a squirrel maybe, but it was too quick to be anything else. I cursed because I didn't think to bring gloves. The trees seemed to grow and move as I walked. I just knew they would start following me. I half wished they would. I closed my eyes, counted my steps to keep myself concentrating on where I was going. I forced my eyes open and saw Haunt Woods. I knew it had to be them because the trees were dense and there was no trace of the oncoming dawn light. It was graveyard dark. I was thirsty, so thirsty. I licked my lips. My mouth, tongue, and cheeks were parched deserts. I exhaled so hard my teeth rattled in my ears. I closed my eyes, stood still, trying to listen or sense where to go next. Closing my eyes was the only thing my grandma taught me how to do when I was scared, and I was frightened out of my mind. I needed to focus. Closing my eyes made me ignore what I was seeing and go to what I was feeling, which was more reliable. I stood still and felt a hand take my right one, moving towards my wrist. It started to drag me forward, even with it feeling as if there were bricks in my sneakers rather than my feet. I shifted the shovel to my left hand. Eyes open to follow my unseen guide through the dense grove of trees. I blinked fast to adjust to the early light which stabbed holes through the canopy of trees. The hand was firm in its grasp as it led onward, willing me not to fall. As I walked, the hands on my back infused heat and strength into me, allowing my eyes to remain open. I started to count the light strands through the canopy. There were no more sounds. No crickets, no birds, only my footsteps. As I covered more ground, I began to hear whispers, sudden and harsh. I couldn't make out what they were saying. I couldn't focus on this and not fall prey to the wood. There were more whispers, louder than before. My eyes stung, itched, almost as bad as my neck and chest. I knew I was on the verge of tears, but I was too stubborn to let them fall. I welcomed the harried scamper of squirrels, but there was nothing. I wanted something to fill my ears rather than the silence. There were ever darker trees. The warmth of hands and my steady footfalls towards this tall, black walnut tree atop this small hill. It was an obelisk above the other trees which surrounded it. I tucked the shovel under my left armpit as if it were a protective teddy when the wind started to whistle. I was almost there. I tried to ignore the throbbing in my feet, but they were tired. My left arm and shoulder ached from clenching the shovel. My wrist and back were burning from being pushed and dragged to my final destination. As the heat increased over my back and hand, I wanted to believe they were infusing strength back into me. I needed it as I approached the black walnut tree. It was easily as tall as a two-story house and the color of soot. Big, old, with the earth around it almost swept clean like something had come in and made its home there. I shifted my shovel in my hands and started to dig. Grandpa Deacon, Uncle Tuck, Tamara, help me, I hissed. I dug, ignoring the swelling signs of the wind. The gust hurled my chest first against the thick stump of the tree. I felt the blood break through my cheek as the bark dug into it. I couldn't scream. I couldn't see with all the dirt and debris being flung. I began groping around in the dark. I wished for the hands that guided me here to help me search. My grandmother's gris-gris was burning, no longer content to provide the distraction of itching. My head and ears rang. I couldn't breathe. My chest ached from being ragdolled into the tree. I looked up to find I was knee-deep in the hole I made and hadn't found anything. I dug faster. I began pleading for the world to stop. I needed more time. I needed the itching to stop. I needed the tightness and burning of my chest to ease. I had to find the head. I began to wonder if the Husson caught me, would he kill me? I thought of what it would be like to have my head severed, to feel what Tamara felt for the last time. My hands were raw from digging. I closed my eyes from the pain, and my left hand brushed against something hard. I opened my eyes with the wind blowing and saw what looked like a hip bone. The wind still blew with the same strength that hurled me against the tree. I was sure if I stood taller in the grave I dug, I would have been thrown into another tree. There was at least 4 or 5 skeletal pieces. I dusted dirt from them and found a piece of red cloth. Where is it? The wind sounded like a locomotive, loud and oncoming. I tried to steady my breathing, clutch my chest. The bruise was bigger than I thought. I couldn't breathe as deep as I wanted. My eyes watered from the chill the wind gave. The cold ripples inched down my back, reminded me how alone I was, reminded me of exactly where I was. Among the wind, I heard hooves. I was able to climb out of my waking grave in time to see it, even while it was still way off. The stabs of light let me see what I thought was a horse's head. The horse was charcoal black. I knew what I was seeing was probably what Grandpa Deacon saw. There was no rider's face I could see. I thought the horse could smell me. I knew it could. The rider wore a cape with a high collar, the hood obscuring the face, the clothing dark and leather looking. The cape was long, as dark as the horse he sat on. The horse bucked and neighed as the hooded rider pulled the reins, the boots he wore crusted with clay. I stood and waited. I wanted to make sure this was what I thought it was. My eyes held open by the wind, my right hand wrapped around the iron nails for protection. The wind, akin to a train whistle, revealed the rider had no head. I left the shovel and started to walk slowly towards the direction of Gallows Bridge. The wind stopped long enough for me to hear my heartbeat in my tightened chest. I tried to remember the way I had come, needed to be calm enough to remember. I gulped air and began to dart around the trees to follow the stabs of light. I looked over my shoulder and saw the horse turn with flattened ears. I screamed when the rider clapped the reins. I ran toward Mr. Curtis's farm, which was a landmark to the lake and the saving grace of the bridge. I started at full sprint. I heard the hooves behind me, that sound of hard rain with the incessant angry neigh of a horse. My chest still wasn't loosening. I couldn't feel the gris-gris. My chest began to feel like I swallowed fire. It began to ache to inhale. I ran. I didn't know how far the Husson was behind me. I looked over my shoulder, saw the red eyes of the Husson's horse. Another scream ripped through my throat, more fire put in. The horse rode down on me as if it carried the fury of a tsunami. It might as well have had wheels as fast as it ran after me. My feet ached and my pace slowed, like I was in cement. I clenched my fist, summoned whatever energy lingered in my body. I heard the hooves go past me as I hid behind a tree. I demanded my lungs not to burn, told my knees to loosen, screamed in my head for my feet not to ache. I ran in the opposite direction, knowing there was a shortcut to Mr. Curtis's property and the bridge. I couldn't hear anything, even my own footsteps. I kept going. Don't fall, don't fall, I repeated as I ran, feeling no extra speed or strength. I tripped over a tree root, but when I got up, my feet slid from under my own weight. The leaves, damp and slick from the night before, gave me no extra help. I ran over the cognitive map of the area by Mr. Curtis's property, assured myself that when I could see it, I would be okay. The Husson would not take my life, not like this. I got toward the end of the darkest part of the woods. I ran over a fallen branch and heard neighing. I looked over my shoulder, saw him steadily closer to me, the eyes of his horse as red as Tamara's dress the night she left the world. His sword unsheathed, the sound louder and similar to my grandmother sharpening her kitchen knives. But it was light. The sun was at my chest. I could see the outline of the bridge over the foggy horizon made by the lake and the sun. Is this how Tamara ran? Is this how Ryan outran her, let her fall behind him? Was the last image he had of his high school sweetheart the Husson sword slicing into the flesh of her neck, separating her head with the face made pretty hours earlier? Did she scream when the Husson grabbed her hair? Was Ryan able to help her while the Husson pulled her from the comfort of the ground? Did Ryan watch as the blood coated the sword, the rage against our family assuaged, quenched, for a moment, with the blood of my sister? My heart beat against my bruised chest. Whatever protection my grandmother's gris-gris gave me was gone. I couldn't feel it anymore against the itching of my chest. My lungs felt like I was taking breaths of sulfur and fresh volcanic ash. My legs were heavy. My feet were about to break off, they hurt so bad. My eyes itched. I felt my hair fall over my shoulders, long free from its ponytail. My body softened and went limp, collapsing under my exhaustion towards the slick, muddy leaves of the meadow. There was no more hiding in the forest. No trees, no stabs of light. My eyes were heavy. I saw the bridge, closer now. I couldn't get up. I felt my knees break, the hooves closer. My hands went forward, spent of energy, and everything went black. There was this warmth that infused into me. Hands, 3 or 4 sets of them. The whispers came again, furious and soothing. My hands were wrapped in other hands, with pants being pulled up like a naughty child having a tantrum. My head was swimming. I couldn't focus. And my eyelids fluttered before being forced open. The bridge was more solid. More fog was being burned away by the morning sun. The heat from earlier wrapped around my knees, infusing strength into my muscles and bone. I got to my feet again, half carried and half drugged to the bridge. My feet thumped over the oak planks. The hands and warmth left me to stand in the middle of the safe harbor of Gallows Bridge. I saw the fury of the Hussan manifest in the horse. The horse stomped its hooves and neighed loudly. I clenched my chest. I felt the bruise once more, comforted by the heartbeat and warmth beneath. Tears flowed from my eyes, either from relief or panic. I watched the Hussan on this horse the devil has to keep in his personal stable. He clapped the reins with more force, frustrated at my escape. The horse neighed with more insistence, still willing itself where I was. It was still unable to get more than a hoof on the aged planks under the dark, muddy hooves. The agitation of my getaway was evident in the volume of the whining the horse gave. The horse traipsed and trotted around the entrance to the bridge, stopping before a support beam. The sword hacked at the support beam and I watched chunks of the dark wood fall into the water. The chopping of the bridge left me frozen. I thought this was the way the Hussan saw fit to kill Tamara, Uncle Tuck, and who else knows? The Hussan guided the horse to the other beam, and as his sword glowed white hot, he wielded it with the same determination on the opposite side. I screamed, stuck in the spot I was left in, desperate to move. The Hussan was determined to destroy the bridge, with me on it. As the blows of the sword connected with the wood of the bridge, flames ignited on the right side. They traveled up the structure as if it was a birthday candle. The fire lapped towards the rail where I stood, catching the sleeve of my sweatshirt. The heat was hotter than any oven door I could open. The entrance, which had been my salvation, cracked and crumbled into the water. The hands grabbed the back of my sweatshirt while I put out the fire on my sleeve. I was pulled with the force that knocked me down, and I was sure I was bruised behind. The flames crackled and roared as the structure creaked and groaned, consumed by the insistent heat. The inferno overtook the roof of the bridge, and a support beam fell near my head. I swatted at the embers in my hair. I couldn't scream. My throat still hurt. The swinging stopped as the flames on his sword changed red, then white. I felt splinters in my hand, and the gorge from the nails I gripped. I coughed as I was dropped on the lake's muddy bank with the care of a beach whale thrown up by an ocean. The bridge was burning. My way to get back to Haunt Woods was gone. The air was still. The crackle of the fire consuming the bridge was the only thing to be heard along the call of the crows. My face bled. My hands ached. I had splinters in my elbows and backs of my thighs. I swallowed a scream in my throat, the curses that threatened to wake the dead in that old black walnut tree. The Hussan turned with almost a flourish and at a full gallop, rode back towards Haunt Woods. I failed. I must have dug on the wrong side of the tree. My grandmother Estelle told me, when we went to visit the graveyard where the deacons all rested, why certain stones face the way and toward the sun. Those that's gonna see the Lord's return always faces north, Avery, my grandmother had said. Those that ain't, well, they faces south, away from the sun. I dug on the south side of the tree. I sat watching the bridge burn. My soft cries of the frustration from my rescue became a howl. This howl came from my throat in fury and rage, reminding me of the ache in my chest. The still, fire-warmed air reminded me just how helpless I'd become. My family was cursed. There could be no more denial, no more reasoning away. I, like my grandpa Deacon centuries earlier, would never be free.
Hi, we're here today with Jennifer Harris, author of The Deacon's Girl. How are you, Jennifer?
I'm amazing. How are you?
Doing all right. It's early in the morning here, but I know that you tend to work nights, so this is kind of like your evening, my morning, but I've got my coffee and my oatmeal, so I'm ready to go.
We can do it. Definitely working nights throws the body clock off for, especially if you're off the next day, it kind of throws the body clock off, but being a mother kind of evens all that out, so this is technically my evening.
Well, thank you for joining us for this evening of yours. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to write The Deacon's Girl?
Well, I am telling myself a little bit. I remember when Disney would do the Halloween specials, and one of the specials that they did was The Headless Horseman. I had to be about maybe 7 or 8 when I had first seen this, and me having the mom that I did, and grandma that I did, if anything was animated, they thought it was okay so the kids could watch it. And I remember watching this animated version of The Headless Horseman and just being creeped totally out by it because again, at that stage, you know, kids are very concrete. They want to know why this is, and, you know, they're learning what things are permanent, what isn't permanent. The thing that struck me was there was this character, this entity, that was roaming around the countryside unchecked, mind you, unchecked, without a head. That had always stuck with me. And then as I got into reading more ferociously, and actually found out about Washington Irving and actually the genius that is the Headless Horseman, I thought, oh my goodness. No, you know, and I'm actually, if, you know, I could be a goth cheerleader for a minute. That's actually my favorite scary story, as it were. I think with all the gothic influences that the nation actually has at present and past, that particular story to me has the most weight, because we've all heard these stories of, wounded soldiers in past wars, come, you know, visiting, and even to the point of, you know, having visitations at home or visitations at hallowed burial sites, like I believe it is Arlington National Cemetery. That's one of the most haunted places in the world. So for the inspiration for The Deacon's Girl actually is extrapolated solely from Washington Irving, solely from that idea of, you know, even though we know that the protagonist in Washington Irving's story is Ichabod Crane, I was thinking, what if I flipped it on its head? What if it actually were a young woman, and a young woman of color, whose family is affected by this? And again, that's where it goes from the Tim Burton mythology. According to Washington Irving's story, there's a Continental soldier who blows his head off with a cannon. Automatically, when I read that as a younger person, I thought, well, that's pretty rad that you thought it would be cool to have somebody's head blown off with a cannon. You know, who would think that in early colonial America? And from that, the Burton influence comes in. And of course, you've seen his version of Sleepy Hollow, which I think is also kind of has that Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle feel to it. But in looking at that, I thought, what if instead of it being the little girls in the Tim Burton movie who see the Hessian and she breaks the twig, and then here come the Continental soldiers. I'm thinking, what if it were a slave that actually saw this happen? What if it were a person who, by virtue of position, sees this and yet can't do anything? The powerlessness, already the institutional racism, already the systemic suspicion. We know that according to American history, there were certain slaves who, if they decided to fight for the colonies, they, I believe, to fight for a year, they were granted their freedom. So what would it look like if there was a slave who saw this happen and then had to keep it a secret? So in that rue, as I call it, came the Deacon's Girl, because I was actually tired of, you know, the I was I'm actually quite sick of the white male protagonist in horror movies, or the white female protagonist in horror movies. You know, why can't it be someone who looked like me trying to affect change, trying to escape, and not being the token?
Especially in these gothic type stories, I think that that's something that, you know, we don't get to see a lot. And for those of us who really enjoy those sort of classic gothic stories, getting to see ourselves and imagine ourselves in them is amazing.
Exactly. I mean, it's monumental. Even while I was writing it, crafting Avery, there was a part of me that, as I continued and revised the work, that thought, this is exactly what I would have wanted to see when I was that 8-year-old girl. Even to the point of when Fox was doing Sleepy Hollow, and the person helping Ichabod Crane was a Black woman, and she wasn't helpless. She was, you know, she's focused, she's engaged, she's knowledgeable. She's not just a prop. And I feel sometimes in you know, dark literature, especially in the horror genre, Black women are not utilized, or we're utilized in this space that's kind of like the witch, the sage, or the token.
Bonnie Bennett from The Vampire Diaries, yes.
That there is a whole dissertation, but we'll focus.
We'll put that to the side. Let's talk about Sleepy Hollow for a minute. The show that was on Fox got canceled, all that good stuff.
I was heartbroken.
So was I, but I felt like the second season was, like, it started to go downhill. Like, you could tell there was, I don't know.
Yeah.
I loved the first season, though. But I'm curious as to what you think about that particular backstory for the main character.
I think, as far as the Fox show is concerned, I love what they did with the first season, because we see, again, with using the Disney version, as if I'm even allowed to say version for that, because we know that's completely watered down just so kids can enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love that they still had the Irving story as its source material. I love that they extrapolated from that. I love that they allowed there to be people of color in this space of extraordinary things happening, that she's sentient, she's present, she's strong. We know her sister's off, but you know, her sister has a reason to be off.
Yeah.
I love the dynamic that she and her sister had. I love that Ichabod isn't, even though he's on this shifting kind of like Jules Verne adventure, you still see him still sentient, still present, and not and treating her as an equal and not less than. I love that they crafted her in a way that only a Black girl could be. In watching the show, I was excited because, again, where you would normally see someone who is a non-person of color operating in these spaces, there was somebody who looked like me doing what you would normally see someone else who was not Black doing, if that makes any sense. You know, she wasn't a prop.
Right. And I think, you know, the criticism that a lot of people of, let's say, mediocre intelligence have about inserting diversity into these classic tales, we'll say, is that, well, you know, there were no Black people in it to begin with, or you're changing the source material, or, you know, you're changing the whole feel of it. And I feel with Sleepy Hollow, they didn't do that. They enhanced what was already there. And, you know, I don't think that's always the case, but I do think that in a lot of instances where people criticize diversity in particular, especially when we talk about classics like Sleepy Hollow or like anything from Poe, that adding those characters in and filling out the story, because they were short stories to begin with, you know, there's so much more to explore there.
Exactly.
And I would love to see more of that, you know, especially in some of Poe's stories, because I'm a huge Poe fan.
Yes. Just to piggyback on what you said, I think that when we have, you know, literature like Poe, and even to some extent, some of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's work, and now, you know, for this particular space, Washington Irving's work, I think what happens is we canonize short stories like that. You know, we remove them from outside criticism or outside interpretation. We exclude anyone else who may not be, you know, white and male to try to extrapolate, to try to expand, to try and project their imagination onto the source material. I think that is a detriment to anyone who writes in the horror genre, only because there are certain things that we find throughout this diaspora of, you know, dark literature, horror, you know, horror writing, speculative fiction. There are certain tropes that you keep coming across. You know, you find the Draculas, you know, you find the Frankensteins, you know, you find, you know, the spirits and imps and things like that. You know, you find the hoodoo, you find the voodoo, you find those things. But the one thing that you don't find is someone whom is not, as Viola Davis said, you don't find someone who is not white pushing that imagination. There's no room, as it were, to extrapolate any further. You know, you have, you know, the story of Sleepy Hollow is now a 200-year-old story. It's a 200-year-old short story. So from there, it almost seems as if you were Black and reading this, that's not possible, because prior to the mid-19th century, you weren't even considered a person. So because you're not a person, you weren't able to read. So if you're not able to read, you're not able to have any imagination. If you're not able to have any imagination, then how can you then superimpose what we believe you don't have onto something that we believe is sacred and applicable only to us?
But then they can write stories about dogs as the main character, but that's neither here nor there.
right.
But, you know, I think the other thing too is Sleepy Hollow in particular, the TV show, is in a lot of ways symbolic of the fact that throughout history, you know, you've seen these white dudes, right? They're the main characters. They're the ones out there doing the thing. But 9 times out of 10, there's a woman behind them, helping push them, doing what they can within the limits of society that they had. And I think that Sleepy Hollow is also an exploration of the fact that, yeah, there's this white dude, he was doing all this other stuff, but the real action was happening sort of behind the scenes with these women that were actually responsible for everything.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the Facebook Live video that you did. Yeah, so November 11th. So you did this Facebook Live video and where you responded to some rumors that Stephenie Meyer was resistant to casting people of color in the Twilight movies. And one of the things that you said that really stuck with me, and you said this pretty close to the end, was melanin sparkles in the light too. And like, I read so many levels into that. Let me tell you what it meant for me, and then we can talk about kind of like what you were, you know, hoping to convey with that line especially, but also with the entirety of the video. Was, you know, I heard that, and I heard, you know, one, when you bring us into the light, we can shine. That was the first thing that I thought of. And I mean, the literal interpretation of it, you know, melanin sparkling in the light, you know, like we look good out in the sun.
Right.
You know? So, I mean, there were just so many levels to that. And, you know, the thing that stuck with me most was the fact, you know, that Nightlight in particular, you know, was something I wanted to do because I felt like Black horror was sort of relegated to the shadows and it wasn't something that was actively explored, and I wanted to bring it into the light, hence the name Nightlight. So I'm curious as to what you were thinking when you did that video. Was that just kind of like an off the cuff statement that you made, or was that something you had written down and planned? Because it sounded like you had that written down and planned, and it was great. And if it was off the cuff, I'm like, okay.
No, that was completely off the cuff.
Well, good for you.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm of the mindset of Christopher Priest. Christopher Priest is actually one of the Black writers who helped to shape Black Panther. He said this about writing. He said, a real writer can write anything. So when I actually heard and read the article by which Stephenie Meyer said that, you know, she wasn't really trying to hear, you know, they're casting more people of color, it threw me back to a place of me being that 12-year-old girl of, you know, liking what my dad would call dark stuff. You know, my favorite movie of all time still, as of right now, still is Christine. You know, I've been a fan of Stephen King since I was like in third grade. I have been a fan, an adamant fan of Anne Rice since I was about 13. I didn't even know Tananarive Due existed until I was in high school. This is why I believe that the live was necessary, because there are girls, there are young women, there are young and young men too, whom grew up in an era where there was no nightlight, where there was no All You're Afraid of the Dark, where there was nothing representative of us as a people as far as the genres that we were able to create. Octavia Butler said that when she was writing, Wild Seed and Kindred, she said that, you know, she knew she was a rare bird. And when I read her quote, because I oft now, you know, bathe myself in her wisdom, because again, I call her, like I do Maya Angelou, a grandmother oracle. All we have from them now is letter. We don't have anything else. The last thing Octavia wrote was Fledgling, which is mind blowing. I mean, because that her take on vampires and fledgling is incredible. When I read that, I want to burn everything I had. I'm like, you know, clearly I'm doing this writing thing wrong, because I need to be doing it just like this.
Yes. Yes. That's honestly my favorite book of hers.
She's incredible. But as far as looking at, you know, Twilight and things like that, my first thought was, they legit don't see us. Like, you legit don't see us. We're bigger than Tia Dalma in the Pirates of the Caribbean. We're more transparent than that. We're more than I know you've seen Interview with the Vampire. We're more than the slaves along.
Got that movie memorized.
Man, right. So, I mean, so, you know, we're more than the slaves along the Delta. We're more than that. As I tell my husband, you know, we've talked about upbringing and even that, I don't want to say imposing, because I too am a believer in Christ, but we understand what happened to us as a people that made us cling to faith. We also know that, especially if you have any family that comes from Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, or any part of Texas, you have a casual knowledge of hoodoo. You have a casual knowledge of voodoo. You have a casual knowledge of it. You may not know what it was, because when you grew up with, like, oh, you know, it's just what, you know.
Just superstition.
Right. You know, she throws salt over her shoulder. You know, you pour salt around the perimeter. You know, if you bless a house, you pour salt. If you see spirits, you know, you put salt all the way around the house. You know, you make sure your door is wrought iron. You know, you know, my grandmother told my aunt when she was building her house, you know, don't use new wood so demons can't get in. So to have someone with the clout, as it were, of Stephanie Meyer to say, you know, I'm just not going to cast people of color. To me, that I was incensed, because I'm like, again, y'all don't see us. We're not given the capability to be extraordinary.
And they don't want to see us.
They don't want to see, and you clearly don't want to see us in any capacity that is extraordinary.
Right. They don't want that stereotypical view challenged.
Right. Which goes back to, why can't we re-examine the Irving story? Why can't we re-examine and revamp Stoker? Why can't we know who Charles Chestnut is? You know, why is it that, as it relates to Black writers, we only can write about matters of faith, love, or heartbreak? As I said in my live, not everybody is bent toward the happily ever after. Not everybody is bent that way.
Right. Exactly. Because life isn't bent that way.
Right. I mean, again, going back to the Christopher Priest quote, if you consider yourself a writer, there should be nothing off limits to you. If talent and time permit, you should be able to touch multiple genres, if that's what you desire to do. Just by virtue of you being melanated should not exclude you from writing something that's extraordinary. So melanin sparkling in the sun, I'm like, because, you know, we too are that thing. You know, to say that, when, you know, again, because when she says in the article that, you know, my vampires sparkle in the sun, so do we. You know, the one thing I hang my hat on is, Anne Rice's, witch vampire, Merrick. When I found out that that the book Merrick existed, I'm like, this, because, you know, as a little gothy girl, maybe I didn't want my boyfriend to sparkle. Come on. Maybe I didn't want Edward to sparkle. Maybe in the eyes of a, let's just say, a dark leaning African-American girl, maybe I wanted Edward to maybe kind of look like, I don't know, Michael Ealy. Maybe I wanted him to look like Idris Elba. Maybe I wanted him to look, maybe I want to look like Steph Curry. Maybe I wanted him to be representative of what I see in my day, in my day-to-day reality.
Absolutely. So what do you have out that we can read right now? And what work do you have coming out soon?
Oh my, that's a loaded question. What I actually have out now is a novel called Ruby. Ruby was written from it's not a horror novel, but trust, there are some other things brewing that I'll speak about in a minute. But Ruby is my first novel, and it's actually out on Amazon now, R-U-B-Y, Ruby like Ruby Dee the actress. The premise of it came from, you know, I work in healthcare, I work in long-term care, and I've seen people who have dementia. What I thought was, what if there was a guy who had dementia, and then his wife found out that she was really never the one that he wanted to be with?
That sounds juicy.
I told my mother this, and she goes, Jennifer, that's horrible. Jennifer, that's horrible. And I said, well, you know, again, not everybody has the bent to the happily ever after. And, you know, we find out that, you know, just a quick juicy rundown. We find, you know, my protag is a guy named Ruben Lewis. He's married to this woman named Catherine. They've been married about 40 years. And then he loses his keys. And then he finds them 2 weeks later, but forgets what the keys are for. And then he starts calling for a person he only identifies as Ruby. And his sister is kind of covering for him as far as when Catherine asks her, you know, who, what is Ruby? And she won't answer her. And then they find out that after an accident, that Ruby actually was an African-American woman he had a relationship with. And Ruben's white.
Awesome. So what do you have upcoming?
What I actually have upcoming, there's a couple books of poetry that I'm working on. One is called For Black Girl, which is a collection of poems and essays. I know, much like you, navigating these spaces of being, you know, Black, female, and increasingly intelligent, sometimes when you're in a room, people can't fathom that you've made it this far. So, you know, you get the backhanded compliments of, you know, you're pretty for a Black girl, or you're smart for a Black girl.
Ooh, so well spoken.
So I'm actually collecting essays now for that work. And actually, I can kind of reveal this now because I've actually been toying with it. I'm actually conducting research now to perhaps make The Deacon's Girl its own standalone novel.
Woo! Insert applause here.
I believe that it's a labor of love. I actually like Avery. I like that she's brave. I like that she's resourceful. I like that she's vulnerable. I like that when, you know, she's confronted by these multiple tragedies, these multiple traumas, that she doesn't do, quote, the typical Black girl thing of just swallowing it. She wants to do something about it. She wants to be able to be proactive in her own existence, which is what I encourage the Black women whom are in my space to do on a day-to-day basis. She doesn't let her circumstance define who she is. Even though she's in this confine of, you know, I can only do this, I can only be this, you know, these forces here, these boundaries here are limiting me, but it will not stop me. And on the other hand, she still grieves the fact that, you know, this happened to her sister. So, you know, what do you do with that? You know, she still has to deal with the fact that, you know, her parents won't really embrace the fact that this has happened. So I like Avery, and I think Avery has more to say.
I think so too. And I can't wait to read it. Is there anything else we can do to support you?
I actually have a blog that I run called The Ideal Firestarter. Yes, Firestarter as far as the Stephen King book, which is also one of my favorite books of his. I actually did a whole, for the month of October, I kind of did fear, and I thought it was going to go one way as far as things that go bump in the night and things that I was scared of as a kid. But it actually went into this whole self-revealing vulnerability month for me. Like, okay, you know, these things have happened to me, and these things have happened to people that I know. And even with breaking down, you know, who is the ideal fire starter, what is the ideal fire starter, which is kind of a double entendre, as far as you know, I used to be kind of a pirate when I was little. You know, it kind of is. And also I believe that ideas and words spark. My mom says it this way. She goes, it has to be said, and it has to be said by somebody. So that's where the Ideal Firestarter comes in. That's on WordPress. Again, theidealfirestarter, all one word, .com. I post there every Monday. every Wednesday, and every Friday is Run It Back Friday. So all my published works are there also, all the cool stuff that I'm doing. And also on Facebook, I am Jennifer P. Harris. You can just search that. And if you'd like to search the page specifically, I believe it is The Phoenix Also Rises. So all my pro stuff is there. All the new projects that I'm doing, collabs that I'm doing are all there.
Awesome. So I will put all of those links in the show notes. Y'all make sure that you follow Jennifer. Thank you so much, Jennifer, for joining us today. And thank you for the Deacon's Girl. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks to Jennifer for her wonderful story and interview. Remember, if you enjoy horror fiction from Black writers, we need your help to keep this show going. Unlike the Hessian, we can't live without a head. And for all of us, the head of this podcast are the patrons and members of the Nightlight Legion who make it possible for us to pay Black writers. Everyone involved in Nightlight, except for the writers and narrators, are volunteers, so your donations go straight to Black creatives. There are three ways that you can donate. Number one, Patreon. Go to patreon.com/nightlightpod to join the Nightlight Legion and support us for as little as $1 per month. That's 25 cents per episode if we can reach our GoFundMe goal. Which brings us to option two. You can make a one-time donation via GoFundMe to help us produce weekly episodes for season two. If we reach our $1,500 goal on GoFundMe, that money and the funds supplied by our patrons mean that Nightlight will be self-sustaining. Last season, I was able to contribute about half of the funds needed, but this year some unexpected medical bills crashed the Nightlight party and we need your help to make season two as great as season one. If Patreon and GoFundMe aren't your jam, but you like PayPal, you can be like Ryan, who I kind of want to call Mike just so I can say be like Mike. But anyway, you can make a one-time contribution via PayPal. Any amount helps. We have enough listeners that if each one of you were to donate 50 cents for every episode you listen to, we'd have this podcast completely funded. I know that for some of you, a monetary contribution isn't possible. Trust me, I get it. But we have a way for you to help as well. Rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Stitcher, or other podcast platforms will help us find more fans who may be able to pitch in to help us pay Black writers. You can also tell all your friends about us, both in real life and on social media. Tag us at NightlightPod, and not only will you help us reach more listeners, you'll also put a smile on our faces during those late nights we're hustling to get an episode out for you. So, patreon.com/nightlightpod, paypal.me/nightlightpodcast, or gofundme.com/nightlightpod, or you can shout your love from the mountaintops. Pick one and go do it. Today's episode was produced by Jen Zink, narration provided by Shoshana Simpson, and story edits by Tanya Thompson. Thanks for listening, and until next time, remember, only when it is dark enough can you see the stars.